This meeting of the House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:08 p.m., Wednesday, March 25th, 2026, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Fields, Representative Colomb, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Prox, Representative Elam, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Dibert, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Freer. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. I'd like to thank Cheryl Cole from Records and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Today in House Resources, we will hold an introductory hearing on House Bill 381, creating an alternate volumetric tax for the Alaska LNG project. We have Adam Prestige, president of Glenfarne Alaska LNG LLC, and Mark Begich online, back in the room to kick off the presentation today, followed by staff from the Department of Revenue. Please join us at the table. And we also have Matt Kissinger in the room. And Mr. Begich, please begin your presentation. Oh, we cannot hear you. We can't hear you yet. Are you muted on your end? We're trying to unmute you over here. Well, let's take a brief at ease. Back on record in House Resources, Mr. Begich. Oh, we still can't hear you.
I mean, as a backup, you could just call him on the phone.
Yeah. Can you? We'll take.
How we're zooming in now. He's going to change.
Okay, we'll take a brief at ease.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now. Yes. Thank you.
I apologize. I don't know why my computer is working that way, but I'm on my phone. So hopefully this will work for all of us. You want me to go ahead and start, Madam Chair?
Yes, please. Please put yourself on record and begin your presentation.
Absolutely. This is Mark Begich. I am a contractor, Northern Compass Group, with Brownstein Hyatt, which is a contractor with the Governor's Office, State of Alaska, for the purposes of this legislation or other issues around oil and gas. Madam Chairs, let me first start by saying thank you very much, especially for Monday's meeting. I'm going to be brief because the meat of this meeting today is a lot more detail about the specific legislation, HB 381. Again, we can't emphasize enough how important this project is in the long term for Alaska's long term economic health, and also the goal of making sure we have long term, stable, reliable, and affordable energy for Alaska. I do want to make the point that the number one priority of the project is affordable and reliable energy for Alaska, followed by export opportunity that could create revenue streams for Alaska, and then also driving economic development for the state. Today, you're going to hear a lot of detail, and I know on Monday we had a lot of great questions, good discussion. We have this kind of broken into multiple parts, but the first part will be by Glenfarne and AGDC, just to answer some of the questions you had on Monday, but also just to go through kind of the purpose of this legislation. And then Department of Revenue will go in more detail all the way down to how they create the formulas and all those elements, as well as, if you want, at the very end, they do have a sectional analysis section that they're happy to go through. I know on Monday we had a lot of questions throughout the presentation. Madam Chair, I just ask your indulgence for a little time for them to make the presentation, as they will, each slide kind of leads to the next information block, and they will be available, obviously, for questions, and we'll continue to answer questions after this committee hearing as necessary. But it would be helpful because I know the information flow will, you'll see it unfold as they go through each slide. It is extensive. but this issue is a pretty big issue and needs the detail that I know you all want. So I'm going to pause now. I don't want to go through much more than that other than to introduce the Glenn Farn, Adam from Glenn Farn, and Matt from AGDC that will kick it off, and then they will swap seats or add seats to for the revenue folks to come up and go through their presentation, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Begich. I do want to get through the presentation. We didn't have the opportunity to do that before. We will have multiple, I expect we're going to meet on this multiple times and have the opportunity to ask questions. So, Mr. Prestige, please put yourself on record, and we'll go through with the presentation.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This is Adam Prestige, President of Glenn Farn Alaska LNG LLC. It's a pleasure to be back here with you again.
And this is Matt Kissinger. I'm the commercial director for AGDC and for 8-Star. And I'm going to kick off, if I may, Chair, by talking a little bit about the historic background to talk about how it is that we're talking so much about property tax right now. I've testified in a number of different hearings where I've talked about the history of the project in different phases. There was what I consider the first phase of the True LNG project, which was the producer-driven phase. And that was never going to really work because it was the wrong application of cost of capital. They were the wrong ones to carry the project forward. And then we went through the state-led phase in 2016, 17, and 18. And this was a lot of government-to-government relations, but really it lacked finding the right alignment and allocating the right risks and rewards to the right people. In 2019, we had a major change of tack. There was a change of a lot of the board members and a change of senior leadership of AGDC. And this is where we started what I call the alignment first or the developer-led model. And as part of that, we implemented a stage gate process, which is very common in all major projects. And we set out that the first stage gate would be an economic stage gate. These are often called appraised stage gates, but it's where you go back and you look at the fundamentals of the project and determine whether it's worth continuing to proceed with the project or not. Exxon and BP during that time frame, 2019 and 2020, came and helped us, actually. They funded us, and they also provided subject matter experts. And we worked with them and with the EPC company Fluor, a well-known company that's done a lot of work in Alaska. And we did a cost optimization process where we went through, and during the 2010s, you've had a lot of LNG projects built by developers in the U.S. Gulf Coast. They had modularized a lot of things that hadn't been modularized in the first design of this project. And so we did that. It's called value optimization, or engineering optimization. And we were able to bring down costs, and then we went through what was called the economic stage gate. We presented this economic stage gate in June of 2020. And what we determined was that this project is economic. We had project financed it. We'd restructured it. There was different costs for gas supply and assumptions, and it was competitive, but it was sort of middle of the pack and is still a big project that has a lot of cost overrun risk, and so we felt it needed to be optimized more. And that's when we identified three places to optimize it. One was gas price. We felt that the gas price assumptions were a bit high. You have to remember this gas that we're buying from the producers is bought at the wellhead, which means that it's unprocessed gas. So this can't be compared to market gas. It still has a lot of CO2 in it, as trace H2S and other things that we have to remove. And that's why we have this, what we call the gas treatment plant or Arctic carbon capture facility. And then the loan guarantees is another thing that we identified. So this is 2020. The loan guarantees for this project originated in ANGPA, the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act of 2004. They were $18 billion at the time. They're inflation adjusted, so now they're about $30 billion worth. But they weren't at first written to be used on this project. They were written to be used on a project to build a pipeline down to North America and the U.S. market. Obviously, shale gas made that not worth pursuing. And so in the bipartisan infrastructure law in November of 2021, our congressional delegation were able to amend the original ANGPA provision for loan guarantees so that they could be applied to this project. We also began negotiating, and we continue to negotiate these lower gas prices that are more reflective of a market price for unprocessed North Slope stranded gas. And that did bring the assumptions down further, and we feel that we're working around the proper neighborhood of prices, as you'll see later. We also launched a benchmarking study to look at the property tax. So we dealt with lower oil, or the lowering of the gas price. We dealt with the loan guarantees. But we need to figure out where we even stood with respect to property taxes. So we hired Gas Strategies. And Gas Strategies came in. It's a well-known sort of intelligence firm for energy projects. And they did benchmarking around the U.S. and around the world, including Canada, Mozambique, these other places. And what they found was in all other jurisdictions that we're competing with, there are some provisions. There are either tax holidays, there are PILTs, or there are just lower taxes. And you can see here in a number of jurisdictions just in the U.S. where they utilize these mechanisms. Honing in on the actual numbers, though, is where this really comes to light. We are 10 times greater under our current statutes, 10 times greater than the sort of next highest area for taxes. You can see here that'd be U.S. Cove Point, Maryland at $50 million. And if you do the math on ours, it would be around $500 million a year or more, depending on the capital involved in the project. We're not the only ones, though, or this Gas Strategies study was not the only ones to identify this. WoodMac also looked at this project in 2022, and that was a competitive analysis to sort of supplement what we had done through this economic stage gate. And in there, they identified property taxes as one of the largest burdens. They said it had the greatest impact of all the sensitivities other than CapEx overrun, cost overrun risk. And then just recently, Gaffney Klein presented their report that was, I believe it was sanctioned by the legislature or commissioned by the legislature. They presented this, I think it was last week, in Senate Resources. And the quote out of that presentation was, Alaska's property tax is one of the biggest potential burdens on project economics. So it's long been established that property tax was going to be a barrier to this project that we'd at some point have to deal with. It was identified even further, you know, earlier than when I mentioned, even during the producer-driven efforts, there was this concept of PILT, and I think the Municipal Advisory Gas Pipeline Board. So that leaves us where we are today. Adam.
Thank you, Matt. This is Adam Prestige for the record, through the chair. So when we talk about property tax reform and we talk about its impact, we're not just talking about numbers on a spreadsheet. We're talking about real impacts to the project and real impact to Alaskans. When Glen Farne came into the project, and every day since, our driving goal on the gas line has been to deliver the lowest possible cost gas to Alaskans as quickly and as safely as possible. This alternative tax proposal is a key element in doing that. Anytime you have a major cost associated with a project, that cost is ultimately borne by those who pay for the gas. The revenue to pay for to build this project and to pay for all of the costs associated with the project come from customers buying gas on the other end of the pipeline. So essentially, this current existing property tax has a direct impact on consumer energy bills. The property tax proposal that we have in front of you will lower energy bills for Alaskan families, for governments, and for government entities. As we'll discuss more, our proposal is a volumetric tax, and that might be a term that is not readily familiar to everyone. It is a tax based not on the property itself, but on the volume of gas that is transported on the pipeline. In a sense, we view this as being a very positive way to align our interests and to reflect the value that the project is delivering by saying, if we're transporting more gas, we're going to pay more taxes. It incentivizes for the state more gas to be transported because it produces more revenue. It also works well for the project because it means that as the tax goes up, the revenues that are being generated by the pipeline will be going up at the same time. And so we see that this volumetric tax structure has the best is the best way to align the interests of the project, the state, and the ratepayers. We'll talk much more about this throughout this presentation, and DOR will talk about this, but our view is that the implementing this property tax reform has a very significant impact on the actual ultimate price of gas. And so in some sense, the price of gas could be as much as 25% higher if this property if the property tax remains in place unchanged. That comes down very significantly with this alternative tax that we are now proposing. Next slide. Why is this important to the project? A major capital project like this requires certainty and predictability. It's very capital intensive, and so as lenders and investors come into a project like that, like this, they're saying, how much is this going to cost? What are the annual expenses? How can we forecast the next 30 years of this project to get a sense of how much it will cost and where the investment will get will be paid and how the loan will be repaid? Putting this volumetric tax is very transparent. It's very forecastable. You simply need to look at how much gas is flowing on the pipeline. There is a percent cost per unit of gas transported, and that's your tax. And so what this alternative tax proposal avoids is the potential for years of litigation over the value of the property, relitigation, and I can tell you that lenders or investors would take that uncertainty and reflect it in how they loan and invest in this project. It comes at a real cost. Again, just to reiterate what Matt Kissinger stated, the current two mil property tax rate is significantly higher than the tax rate imposed on comparable North American LNG projects. It is a critical part of the development path for any major piece of infrastructure like this in order to align communities and ultimately, as I said, here in Alaska, deliver the lowest possible cost gas to Alaskans.
With that, we would like to invite our colleagues from Department of Revenue to come up and walk through the actual bill and the impacts of it, where I think that it'll be enlightening to have all that information before we go through questions.
Yes, we can do that. We'll proceed with the Department of Revenue.
Great. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the testifiers table and House Resources. Please put yourself on record and continue the presentation.
Thank you. For the record, Acting Director, Tax Division and Department of Revenue, Brandon Spanos.
And Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with Department of Revenue.
So I'll begin and just go over first a brief background about the current property tax that is in place in Alaska. So the state has a property tax at the state level that only applies to oil and gas property, which is property used in the exploration, production, or pipeline transportation of oil and gas. The property is centrally assessed by our division. Our property assessor assesses the property for both the state and that applies for the munis as well. But the rates or the tax is levied at the municipal level and at the state level separately. The taxpayers can apply for a credit. When they pay their municipal tax, they get a credit on their state tax. So although the state assesses a 20 mil rate, if a muni has a 20 mil rate, you can get the entire tax credit when you file your tax return, or rather when you pay the tax and show the state that you paid it. Property taxpayers I already mentioned that. Sorry, I'll move on. So under current law, the Alaska LNG plant any LNG plant is exempt from state tax level. However, the local property tax would apply to an LNG plant. So moving on to slide 12. I'll go over the proposed legislation in the bill. And so on slide 13, as we've already heard from the previous testifiers, the current property tax in place for Alaska is an economic burden on an Alaskan LNG project, and the tax would be passed on to the consumers to include Alaskan residents. This bill would replace the state-level property tax for the LNG project with an alternative volumetric tax that would be exempt, or rather, it would exempt the project from the tax for a period of up to 10 years, and I'll get into that a little bit more in the next slide. Once the project reaches full capacity, the volumetric tax would be roughly equivalent to a 2 mil property tax. And we saw on an earlier slide, we said the current 2 mil tax, it's a 20 mil tax currently. But this volumetric tax would be equivalent to a 2 mil tax. So moving to slide 14, I'll walk through how the tax structure works under the under this proposal. So first, there is a defined ramp-up period, and this period lasts for the earlier of either 10 years of commercial operation or the point at which the project's 30-day average pipeline throughput exceeds 1 billion cubic feet per day. So if that's earlier than 10 years, then that would be the trigger to turn on the volumetric tax. So once the ramp-up period ends, the alternative volumetric tax is set at 6 cents per 1,000 cubic feet of natural gas moving through the pipeline. And from that point forward, the tax rate increases gradually by 1% each year. And finally, the levy is allocated based on where the infrastructure is located. So the 6 cents tax is shared among the local municipalities according to the portion of the project within each jurisdiction. And the section that fall within the unorganized borough would come into the state coffers. And overall, the tax structure is designed to give the project time to reach full operational capacity while ensuring stable, predictable revenue for both local governments and the state. And now I'll turn it over to Dan for review of the fiscal note and the modeling.
All right, again, for the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. So starting with slide 16 looks at the revenue impact of the fiscal note. So as we were putting this together, we had some questions about exactly how to show the impacts of the bill on the fiscal note. The bill would result in lower state revenue if the gas line project were to go forward regardless of property tax relief. However, the developer and the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation have stated that the project will not go forward without property tax relief. And so in the fiscal note, we are showing the revenue impact of this bill as a positive to state revenue. The fiscal note shows only the state's share of the alternative volumetric tax revenue. Under our baseline scenario, we estimate that the state would receive about 12% of the total tax revenue from the bill. The remainder would go to the municipalities, and that's not reflected in our fiscal note. Looking at slide 17, so again, we discussed how to reflect this fiscal note with Office of Management and Budget and Governor's Legislative Office. The fiscal note protocol is to only show direct revenue from the impacted tax itself. So the fiscal note reflects our expected revenue from the alternative volumetric tax. Under our baseline scenario, it does not show the potential impacts of other revenue sources, which would include state corporate income tax, production taxes, property tax from new development, or state royalties. And what we've done is we've prepared some supplemental analysis, which is part of this presentation and also part of a supplemental document that we put together that details those other benefits above and beyond what's strictly included in the fiscal note itself. So slide 18 is a table that shows our estimated revenues from the alternative volumetric tax by fiscal year for the next 10 years through fiscal year 2036. There would be no revenue until we reach that 1 billion cubic feet per day threshold. And then fiscal years 2031 through 2033 represent the ramp-up period. And then we are looking at full production through the project beginning in fiscal year 2034 in our baseline scenario. At full operations, the state receives about $9 million per year. for its share of the new tax for the pipeline, the portion of the pipeline in the unorganized borough, and the remainder of the revenue from the new tax would go to municipalities, about $64 to $65 million per year. So our estimate for the purposes of the fiscal note, we assume that the alternative volumetric tax is allocated between the three components, the gas treatment facility, the pipeline, and the LNG export facility. We assume that that allocation is done based on the initial capital cost of each of those. And then for the pipeline portion, where the state receives a component, we assume that that allocation is done based on the miles of the pipe in the unorganized borough versus organized boroughs. That is one assumption. We would develop regulations on exactly how to do that allocation for tax administration purposes, but that is the assumption that we've built into our fiscal note and our revenue modeling. In terms of expenditures on slide 19, the way the alternative volumetric tax is set up, it would create a new tax type within the tax division, so there would be some additional costs to administer this new tax. We estimate that we would need one additional staff position to carry out the administration of the new tax, and there would also be one-time costs for updating our tax revenue management system to incorporate the new tax type. So the capital cost for that one-time upgrade would be estimated at $250,000, excuse me. And then slide 20 details the ongoing operating expenditures in the fiscal note for the one new position, averaging about $170,000 per year for salary and related expenditures. And then the next set of slides gets into some detailed project modeling. Starting on slide 22, so I'm going to spend several slides walking through kind of our model structure and all of the detailed assumptions that go into it before I get into the results itself, just to really give context on where these numbers that I'm presenting came from. So our modeling is broken out into two main components. We have an upstream model. So this is a model that estimates cash flows and revenues to the producers on the slope before the gas is sold into the AKLNG project. So this would be the impacts of gas production on the producers, as well as any knock-on oil impacts due to expanded production on the North Slope. And then we have a separate midstream model, and this is where we estimate the cash flows and revenues from the AKLNG project itself. This includes modeling of the gas treatment plant, the pipeline, and the export facility. Slide 23. So our modeling is based on many assumptions, and this slide shows the sources of those various assumptions. The spring 2026 revenue forecast that was released earlier this month is the source of many of the assumptions into our modeling, including for oil prices, company spending, and oil production. Our official forecast does not include gas line sales revenue. So the gas line revenue would be over and above what's in the department's official forecast. That's been the protocol for the longstanding protocol of the department. Most of our project-related assumptions have been provided by AGDC, including key assumptions around project cost, gas pricing, and what the levels of additional upstream development would be that would be associated with the project. Slide 24 details some of the financial assumptions. So our modeling covers a period of 30 years of production at full project capacity. We assume that the project would likely extend beyond that, but for modeling purposes, we model 30 years of full capacity, and then 2 years of ramp up. So a total of 32 years of LNG sales in our modeling. We assume that there will be pipeline tolls set based on a 20-year period of full capacity, and that the developer will set those tolls based on a 10% internal rate of return. Again, that's an assumption that we, you know, can run sensitivities on. We assume a total project cost of about $46 billion in current 2026 dollars. That is based on a pre-Glenfarne project cost that was provided by AGDC. We've adjusted that to current dollars based on inflation. And again, understand that there's some uncertainty around that exact $46 billion number, and so we do run extensive sensitivities on different potential project costs. Slide 25 details some of the upstream assumptions. So we're assuming a gas purchase price of $1.50 per 1,000 cubic feet in 2026 dollars. That's based on advice from AGDC, and again, we have sensitivity analysis around that, since it is a key assumption into the project, what the price paid to the North Slope producers will be for the gas. We assume that initial phase one production will come from a source that is not Prudhoe Bay or Point Thompson. That could be Great Bear Pantheon. That could be another field on the North Slope. But Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson are assumed to come in as part of phase two, which is the full LNG export project. And we assume that those two fields will anchor the project for the majority of the project life. For Prudhoe Bay, we assume no impacts on oil production, and that is a significant assumption into the modeling. There's reasons that oil production could increase with gas sales. There's reasons that oil production could decrease with gas sales. We assume that those will roughly balance out, and so we are not modeling any change to Prudhoe Bay oil production. We do assume a significant increase in liquids production from the Point Thompson field. We assume that gas production will result in significant additional investment and development of that field, resulting in about 270 million barrels of additional oil production over the life of the field. And this additional oil production from Point Thompson is a major component of the state benefits when you look at the upstream impacts of this project. Slide 26 lays out the baseline tax assumptions. So in our baseline, before applying the proposed legislation, we do assume that the full 20 mils or 2% property tax would apply to the gas treatment plant and the pipeline, and then the LNG export facility, which is exempt from state taxation, would pay the municipal tax at 8 mils or 0.8%. We assume that the project developer would not be subject to state corporate income tax. And we assume that some but not all of the upstream producers would be subject to state or corporate income tax, which is in line with the current situation. For production tax, that is a very detailed and complex modeling project. We've fully modeled out our current tax law for production tax. For gas, there is a 13% gross tax with a tax ceiling that applies for qualifying in-state gas use. For oil, there is a net profits tax with a gross minimum tax floor, and our modeling includes the complex interactions between the oil tax, the gas tax, lease expenditures, and tax credits. Slide 27 highlights some of the key uncertainties in the modeling exercise. So these include prices, oil and gas. As we've seen over the last month, oil prices are uncertain and volatile. So there's uncertainty around future oil price, future gas price, as well as the prices of various components that will feed into the project costs that the developer will incur. Uncertainty around the future of the LNG markets. Again, as we're seeing that play out in real time, that markets can change and can change quickly. Uncertainty over project timeline and costs, and then uncertainty over the upstream oil impacts. For Prudhoe Bay in particular, as I mentioned earlier, there could be increases or decreases to production. And as well, having the gas line in place could impact the economics and attractiveness of exploration and development and production of oil on the North Slope. And we, outside of the direct impacts to Point Thompson, we're not modeling any of those potential knock-on impacts to oil exploration and development. Slide 28. So two scenarios that we've modeled for purposes of this analysis, and again, we have the ability to model many more scenarios. The current law scenario assumes that the Alaska Gas Line project would go forward without tax relief. And that is really just to provide a counterfactual to show what the economics and revenues would look like if there were not a tax change. And then we model what the revenues and cash flows would look like under this bill, which exempts the AKLNG project from state and municipal property tax and replaces with that alternative volumetric tax. So slide 29 summarizes the key outputs of our modeling under the current law and our baseline assumptions. Without any tax change under the baseline through 2062, we're looking at about $30 billion in state revenues, about $17 billion in municipal revenues, about $60 billion to the upstream producers, and about $70 billion to the midstream component. And to note, these are cash flows, not profits. So the expenses would be paid out of those cash flows that go to the upstream and midstream operators. In terms of cost of supply, our modeling results in a 2033 price of $4.86 per 1,000 cubic feet for in-state and $9.07 per 1,000 cubic feet for LNG sales. These would be the break-even prices for the sale of the gas to the utilities, not the prices paid by the end consumer. And slide 30 shows a chart of what those annual state revenues would look like under our current law analysis. So there would be a little over $200 million per year of property tax to the state and around $600 million per year of royalties and corporate income tax, and about $1 billion per year total revenue to the state from all revenue sources once you add in the oil and gas production tax. And you see in 2038 here, there's a dip in the production tax, and what that represents is kind of a one-time impact of some additional investments that we foresee would be needed at Point Thompson in particular to expand that field. Slide 31 summarizes the key outputs of the modeling under the proposed legislation, again with the same baseline assumptions. Through 2062, there would be $22.5 billion state revenue, which is a $7 billion reduction. There would be $4 billion of municipal revenue, which is about a $13 billion reduction. These $60 billion to the upstream producers would be the same. The alternative volumetric tax applies. It impacts the project developer, the state, the municipalities. It would not directly impact the upstream oil and gas companies. And then cash flow to the midstream is actually $1.5 billion less than under the current law scenario. And the reason for that is with lower costs, we assume that less cash flow and a lower price would be needed to generate the 10% internal rate of return for the developer. In terms of cost of supply, in looking at the 2033 prices with this legislation enacted, we show a $4.43 per 1,000 cubic feet in-state price, which would be 43 cents per 1,000 cubic feet reduction, and a LNG sales break-even price of $8.48 per 1,000 cubic feet, which would be a 59-cent per 1,000 cubic feet reduction. And again, these would be the break-even prices for sales to utilities, not the prices paid by end consumers. Slide 32 shows our annual revenues chart again under the proposed legislation. So it's a similar-looking slide. It's about $200 million per year less across the board, and that represents the reduction in the state share of the property tax. And so next we have a few sensitivity slides, and we know that there's a lot of uncertainties around some of the key assumptions in the AKLNG project. Two of the biggest uncertainties are what will that upstream gas cost or be the price that's paid to the producers, and then what will the ultimate capital cost of the project be? And so since we don't have final numbers on those, we can run sensitivity analysis. And so what this chart on slide 33 shows is the in-state break-even gas prices needed for the developer to break even with that 10% assumed rate of return. And we look at a range of $1 to $5 per 1,000 cubic feet for the gas purchase price. We start with our baseline $46 billion capital cost and run sensitivities on up to 100% higher capital cost. So what if the cost ends up being a little bit or a lot higher than that $46 billion?
Yes, sir. This is a lot of information. Is it possible to just take a beat and just to kind of look at this and try to understand the chart? Because this is good information you've been working on. I want to understand as it's going through. Could we just take a beat just to understand the chart, please?
Sure, Representative Sattler.
Yeah, thank you. And if I may ask questions, then, so on the top, it's upstream gas price per MCF, base CapEx, 100, 80, 60. That's the, what does that represent? Are taking a share? Or, just please explain the chart to me a little bit better, please.
Sure. Representative Sattler through the chair. So on the y-axis, so we have two sets of tables here. So we have our spring 2026 baseline, which is under current law with no property tax relief. And then we have proposed legislation, which is all else equal, but enacting the legislation before the committee. And what we're showing here is the break-even in-state gas price that the developer would require to achieve the assumed 10% internal rate of return for their investment.
Follow-up, Representative
Sattler. And that's the price that the producers would have to get, or the breaking price on whose?
Representative Sattler through the chair. So at the top, we have the upstream gas price. That represents a sensitivity analysis on the price that would be paid to the producers. And then on the left-hand side, we have a capital cost. So our baseline capital cost is the $46 billion in real 2026 dollars.
Okay.
And we run sensitivities if capital costs are 20, 40, 60, 80, or 100% above that $46 billion. So basically between $46 and $92 billion of total capital cost.
Okay.
So what is the price paid to the upstream producers, what is the capital cost for the project, and then holding all the other assumptions equal per our baseline forecast or our baseline analysis, what would the in-state gas price for sales to the utilities, not to the end consumer, but for sales to the utilities, what would that gas price need to be for the developer to break even? What we see is in our baseline with our $46 billion capital cost and $1.50 per 1,000 cubic feet purchase price from the producers, this bill would reduce the break-even gas price from $4.86 sales to the in-state utilities down to $4.43 for sales to the in-state utilities. And you can see that based on just these two assumptions of capital cost and purchase price to the producers, there is a very significant range of potential prices and significant risk for the developer.
And just, we're going to come back to this later, but don't stop.
Yeah, let's proceed with the rest of the presentation. We'll have an opportunity to ask questions afterward.
All right, moving on, slide 34 is a very similar slide to slide 33. This just shows the break-even sales price for LNG delivered into the market. Under this bill, the break-even gas price under our baseline analysis would be reduced from $9.07 down to $8.48 per 1,000 cubic feet. And again, a significant range of potential prices presenting upside risk in particular to the developer.
I'm sure.
Representative Sattler.
Thank you. I'm looking for $9.08. Someplace in this chart I'm not seeing it. Is there someplace I'm just missing it?
$9. It's under $1.50.
Under $1.50. Okay, very good. Okay.
Yeah, Representative Sadler through the chair. So apologies if I misspoke. Under the baseline without our without this legislation enacted, mm-hmm. it's a break-even LNG delivered price of $9.07 per 1,000 cubic feet. And then with the proposed legislation, again, in our baseline, it's $8.48 per 1,000 cubic feet. And again, those represent holding all other assumptions equal to our baseline modeling, the $1.50 per 1,000 cubic feet purchase price to the producers, and then our $46 billion capital cost assumption. And you can see how higher or lower prices and then higher capital cost would impact the required break-even price from there.
Thank you. Representative Fields.
Are we doing questions now or waiting till the end of this?
I'm trying to wait till the end.
Okay, Representative, I'll wait.
Thank you.
40 more slides, don't worry.
We are going to forego the sectional analysis just for the committee's awareness so that we can get questions.
Excellent. Again, Dan Stuckel for the record. Slide 35 is another similar sensitivity chart. So what this shows is state revenues in nominal terms over the life of the project. So under current law, the state and municipal revenues would increase substantially with higher project costs. And what this proposal effectively does is it not only lowers the state and municipal revenues at the outset, but it also makes it so that those revenues and thus costs to the developer would not increase with a higher project cost. And so that's kind of what's being referred to when folks are talking about how this bill would help de-risk the project. And you'd see a similar sort of impact for municipal revenues, but with even bigger numbers since the majority of the property tax impact is on the municipal revenue side.
And just to put a note there, with all of the impact to the municipal revenues, and I'd like to see similar slides of your analysis and what you think the proposed impact would be to not just to the state but also to the municipalities in the future, or you can provide it to us and we can distribute it to the committee.
Absolutely, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
All right, I have two more sensitivity slides, and then we'll be done with sensitivities. Slide 36 is what's called a tornadoes chart. This shows a sensitivity of how a handful of key assumptions could impact the break-even for in-state gas costs. So, again, $4.86 in 2033 is our baseline break-even price for price to utilities for in-state sales that would be required under the current law analysis. And the biggest ways to reduce that price would be through property tax relief and through a lower gas price paid to the producers. The biggest risk on the upside is project cost as well as gas cost paid to the producers. And so that's why we highlighted those two specific assumptions to do our more detailed sensitivity analysis earlier. So what this bill would do effectively is it would de-risk that capital cost a little bit in addition to the direct property tax relief.
For clarification.
Yeah. Through the chair, did you say 486 was the break?
Representative Colomb, through the chair, correct. $4.86 in 2033 dollars. And then slide 37 is a similar tornado chart, but looking at the break-even delivered LNG price. $9.07 is the baseline price under our current law analysis. And again, there's some factors that could reduce that, property tax being one of them. A lot of risk on the upside, with the largest piece of that being a potential capital cost overrun or capital costs coming in higher than what we're assuming in our modeling. And so the legislation before you would reduce the property tax, you know, as shown in that top line, but then it would also de-risk that potential impact of a capital cost overrun in the second line. And that's important, especially if there's a chance that project costs will come in higher than that $46 billion that we're assuming in our modeling. So some conclusions to this modeling exercise. So the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Project, if it's constructed, it would provide billions of dollars to the state, to the federal government, to local governments. It would provide a new revenue stream to upstream producers and to a midstream developer. Would provide jobs and support energy security goals, both for the state and nationally. The bill itself would reduce the tax burden on the developer, making the project relatively more economic, and it would help to de-risk the project in terms of reducing the potential negative impacts of a higher project cost or higher tax assessments, and that is an important benefit of the bill as well.
Thank you. I'm going to ask the committee if you have any questions for the Department of Revenue. We'll ask those, and then we'll move on back to the developer. I've got Representative – I've already started a queue just based off of hands that were – so I've got Representative Fields up first.
Thank you, through the chair. Are the treatment plant and import slash export facilities exempt from muni property taxes under this bill, and if so, could an import plant be built but not a pipeline and remain exempt from property taxes under this bill? Through the chair.
Representative Fields, through the chair. So our analysis assumes that the treatment plant, pipeline, and export facility would be exempted from property taxes and replaced with the alternative volumetric tax. As to what the impacts on an import facility would be at the municipal level, I don't have the answer to that off the top of my head. Okay. One of my colleagues may.
I'll ask a follow-up, and then I'll let others take a turn. Through the chair, you briefly mentioned, I think, what you described as the complex interplay of oil taxes and this bill. Could a company that pays oil production taxes write off capital expenditures for gas infrastructure from their oil production taxes, and could you further elaborate on the interplay of oil production taxes and these tax exemptions? Thank you.
Sure. Representative Fields, to the chair. So I've said many times that we have one of the most complex oil and gas fiscal systems in the world. That pertains primarily to our oil and gas production tax. So the way the production tax works is we have for gas, we have a gross tax of 13% of gross revenue to the producer, with a tax ceiling of 17.7 cents per 1,000 cubic feet for qualifying in-state sales on that gas. For oil, we have a net profits tax with a 35% headline tax rate, a 4% gross minimum tax floor, and per barrel tax credits ranging up to $8 per taxable barrel of oil production. Any lease expenditures for a field that is producing both oil and gas, any lease expenditures are allowed as deductions in the net profits portion of the oil production tax. And then any tax credits and the application of the 4% gross minimum tax floor are applied to the entire statewide tax liability. So there is an interplay where lease expenditures for additional development in a field that's producing both oil and gas can be applied against the oil portion of the production tax, and then there's an interplay where the per taxable barrel tax credits can reduce your entire tax liability, subject to a limitation that some of those tax credits may not reduce below the minimum tax floor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next in the queue, I've got Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. And I'll also just take one topic at a time. So I want to push back a little bit about the necessity of this particular approach to being necessary to accomplish this project. So folks are going to hear me say this multiple times. there's three impacts that we're looking at here on the project: state income, local property taxes, and consumer rates. So the way, with current regulations and statutes, the way we have things now, the state is already foregoing some corporate income tax rates on the upstream and on the midstream. Glenfarne, AgeStar, both S-Corps, it's noted on slide 26 that there's no corporate income tax in that piece. This bill puts the majority of the burden of more giving up more income on the local property taxes. When we look at the slides in the early 30 pages, there's a of what's being given up by the municipal revenue, there's more available revenue on the state level. So there are other levers, and of course, the consumer rates is another piece in there. So this is just one piece. This is only looking at the local municipal property taxes. There are other levers that we can push with these scenarios and not changing anything else to forego state income instead of local property taxes. Is that an appropriate characterization?
Representative Mears, through the chair, to the question of are there other levers that we can pull? Yes, that's an appropriate characterization.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Sadler missed his turn, so Representative Colom.
Thank you, through the chair. I had one of my questions already was asked. My other question was the $46 billion capital cost assumption. Where did that come from?
Representative Colom, through the chair. So that came from an assumption that was provided to us by AGDC in 2023, and we have brought that up to 2026 dollars based on inflation. So that was an estimated project cost prior to Glenfarne taking over as developer of the project.
Follow up. Okay, so if I remember, so the number we usually talk about is $44 billion. So from 2023 to now, it's just $2 billion more.
Representative Colom, through the chair, essentially yes, that would just reflect whichever base year you're looking at for the 44 to the 46 would be just an inflation assumption.
Okay, thank you.
And that was going to be my question. Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, do you have anything else on your plate for the next at least 2 or 3 weeks?
Representative Prox, to the chair, yes.
Cancel those appointments. have you thought about, well, with that 2 or 3 week thing, this is a complicated decision we have to make, and it's disappointing that we haven't been thinking about it for a year, frankly. So have you looked at, in terms of how we got to think about this, the cost to the project of a delayed decision? Somebody's expecting us to have this made. Glenfarne had talked about having the FIDC decision in December, announced later, no fault, those things happen. But if we, how are we going to come to something in a month? Well, for the sake of discussion, assume we can get this decision made by the 21st of May. Have you thought about the cost of delaying this decision? Do we have any guess on how much we're increasing the cost, increasing the risk by overanalyzing this, if you will?
Sure. Representative Prox, through the chair. So from our role in Department of Revenue of, you know, maintaining the modeling, we can certainly run numbers for what happens if we shift everything out another year. I would defer to AGDC and the project developer for more of a qualitative assessment of how that would impact the viability of the project in the market.
Yeah. It's important.
Absolutely.
We have to make a decision, but on the other hand, we can't rush and get into a bum deal. The other one, have you looked at an alternative from the state especially, is getting an ownership share. I think part of the agreement is the state could invest up to 25% or something like that. Have you looked at the impact of the state buying?
Representative Prox, through the chair, yes. We've looked at those options extensively over the years. So this gas monetization modeling, this is a continuation of an effort that we've been making for decades. So we've absolutely looked at scenarios for state investment. I don't have those ready to present here today. Right. The proposal before us at this time is for a developer-led project without a state investment at this time.
I think that it would be helpful to know, well, the potential income side to the state, but also reducing the investment risk. Another financer is in there, that's the state, and cost of interest and all those kind of things.
Right. It would
be helpful to have that.
Yeah, Representative Prox, the chair, would be happy to put something together. Generally speaking, so in the modeling, I mentioned that we assume a 10% internal rate of return.
Right.
That would be basically the starting point for our assumptions on a state investment as well.
Okay. And I'll give somebody else a chance.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm next on my queue.
Ooh, it's a good thing I did that.
Thank you. I have similar questions, and you're the one who's sitting in front of us right now to be able to answer them. We were told early on in session that we should expect to have a bill in front of us and pass it out within the first 30, 60 days. We didn't receive a bill until mid-March, and we have, we're more than halfway through the legislative session. This is a really big push for us to do, and we have lots of questions, and I really... similar to Representative Prox, we will be asking you to return back to House Resources to further analyze some of these questions. But because you're the person who's sitting in front of me, I talk with my local borough mayor, and I know that other folks are as well. I know that there were conversations that were being had starting in December, continuing into January, and occurring weekly with AGDC. And I don't know if you're part of those conversations, but can you describe the coordination? And maybe it's AGDC who answers this question. The coordination with all of the affected municipalities as this was developed, and do the municipalities support this bill?
Yeah, Co-Chair Fryer, I would defer that question to AGDC or perhaps to Senator Begich.
Okay. Well, I saw Mr. Kissinger nod his head in the back, and so maybe we can ask him to come up to the testifier's table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Kissinger for the record. And actually, I would like to invite Senator Begich to weigh in on this as well. But we are working very closely with the mayors of the boroughs. It is a dynamic conversation that is going on, right now and through this week and likely next week. It's a very collaborative effort. I think Mayor Michicki mentioned something like feeling like it was a partnership, I think, when he was down here in Juneau a few weeks ago. We hope that that's still the feeling that they have. I suspect this will move a little bit over the coming week, but we are definitely taking into account the views of the municipalities. Senator Begich, did you want to add anything to that?
Yeah. Madam Chair, for the record, it's Mark Begich. I hope you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you.
Very good. Let me elaborate even more detail. We are in constant conversation. Matter of fact, we had a meeting yesterday with the mayors. It was, or day before, very positive. It was on the elements they're looking at. In general, they support the concept of the volumetric tax, the alternative tax. They have some issues in regards to the floor, we call it, in the bill. as well as the inflation factor of adjustment of the rate. All mayors, even as a, like I said, Tuesday, very good conversation. Your mayor is actually down in Houston right now for a conference, so we were unable to connect him in. But we've had conversations last week. All the mayors were contacted, not only by myself via text or call or individual, by the governor, as well as by Frank at the AGDC. Saying that, it is a collaborative effort because it's important to get their input, because at the end of the day, frankly, they're the ones that are impacted in the sense of their revenue stream or potential revenue stream. As we say in this project, that, you know, there is no project, there is no revenue stream until there is a project. So we're, but we are definitely having these conversations, not only directly, individually or collectively with mayors, but also individually with some of their team. And in the case, as Matt has identified, AGDC is hosting those. And then there's additional meetings that are continuing to happen. Like I said, last night I was on a phone call with the mayor of Fairbanks for a period of time. And Friday we have a meeting with the mayor of Kenai. So it's a constant communication.
Thank you. There was a follow or representative or co-chair Dibert had a follow-up question.
Thank you, co-chair Freer. While we have Mr. Begich here in front of us, my question is, I'd just be curious as a follow-up to Representative Freer's question, who or which entity requested this specific revenue measure of in lieu of standard property taxes?
It, as Matt laid out, and he can lay out a little bit more, but in every kind of research or documentation or analysis of this project, property taxes have always been on kind of the issue of the state amount, as well as local communities amount. Mill levy is very high compared to other jurisdictions. So that's come through multiple reports by independent analysis that we should look at the property tax. So the bill has been introduced at the governor's request to the legislature to adjust this. And the volumetric tax is a lot of positives to it. In the case of, for example, right now, if you're a local community, take Kenai, take with any of the five that are affected, you have to value the current assets that oil and gas companies have. That's the current assessment process. The skill sets and the capacity for municipalities to assess those appropriately always seem to be ending up in litigation against the oil and gas companies. Matter of fact, there's one that the state has that I think is now 10 years of litigation. This simplifies it. The valuation is not the issue, it's the flow that goes through. You can count what goes through on a daily basis. It's easy to calculate, lowers the risk of litigation. But the state has requested that via the governor, but it has come up time and time again in every report for years that this is a problem component of the financeability of this project.
I believe Representative Fields had a follow-up.
Yes, through the chair, probably to Senator Begich or Matt Kissinger. I mean, conceptually, I like the AVT structure, but I did have, I think, three questions related to interaction with municipalities. One, has there been discussion yet, or have you all drafted potential language that would let municipalities receive an equity share in the gas line in exchange for a reduction in property taxes, that localities would have the option of either an equity stake or collecting AVT on an ongoing basis? I was also curious if you all have discussed with municipalities how to incorporate construction of the Fairbanks spur line in the project with a structure to amortize those costs over a long duration and spread those costs across the entire pipeline corridor, so that there would be a financially viable way of bringing gas to Fairbanks. And then the third local question is, has there been discussion with localities of altering the AVT structure under the bill so that Anchorage would receive some share to offset the costs that will naturally occur on local services with such a large project? Thank you.
Senator Begich, if you'd like to take the first and third, I'll take the second. Yeah.
Okay. Let me, again, Mark Begich for the record. Thank you, through the chair. Thank you very much for your question. Let me start on, I'll actually whip through all three, and then Matt, you add to number two for sure. But first, the equity component, we know there are some issues or interest, I should say, by municipalities for equity. We have no issue with that. Matter of fact, there is discussion on the 5 to 25% equity position that in each component of this project, that is available for not only state, but it could be available for municipal governments. We're not objecting at all to that. We think if there's some interest, we'd be very interested to see their how they want to structure that. But two, on the spur line, there is literally last night, this conversation with the mayor of Fairbanks, we are in the kind of information gathering. There is currently an LOI between NSTAR and Doyon Corporation to build that spur line. The issue is some detail of the current structure they have. I think they have about 3,500 customers in the current system, but they have also some contractual requirements with Harvest/Hillcorp in regards to the buy that they have to do on that gas. But putting that into the equation, there is a desire to figure out how to solve this problem with the pipeline coming right next door. The thing we're trying to avoid, and as you saw, the cost sensitivity of this project is not heavy loaded on the front end. So you then make the project unable to be financeable because you just put too much on the front end. But saying that, there is some fairly strong and aggressive conversations going on right now, as late as late last night, on this spur line issue. So, you know, is there a solution? Probably. Is there an opportunity to front load this onto this project? I would say we got to be careful, very careful, because it's a marginal project now, and anything we add to the cost will make it even more harder to finance from a private sector equity position. The last and third, Anchorage, the mayor, and I think you asked it last week, I think the mayor's of Anchorage will be engaged in this process. They've already been met. They've met with Glen Farne in regards to how the Port of Alaska will be impacted and how that can be dealt with in a short order. So there are some conversations, but a little different than the five affected boroughs in the sense of where the pipe goes through, because they are the property tax impacts based on state law. But Anchorage is not excluded from a conversation. Matt, did you want to add additional to that?
Yeah, Matt Kissinger for the record. Just to add on the Fairbanks spur, this is one that's dear to my heart. We're absolutely going to work with Fairbanks and get affordable gas into Fairbanks through the spur. There are a number of different tools that we have to do that, and we're exploring all of those right now. We do want to make everyone understand that in phase one is more about energy security and the predictability of our pricing. We are not going to have lower prices in South Central Alaska with phase one. We're going to have prices that are competitive with importing LNG and with where Cook Inlet prices are now going, but they won't be lower than that in phase one. We will get gas to Fairbanks in phase one as well, but again, in order to get people to really switch quickly, we need to get to phase two where we can get cheap gas to Fairbanks. What we're also looking at in Fairbanks, though, is cheap electricity. And you really can't overlook this aspect of it. Right now, the interior, as I mentioned on Monday, is this blank canvas. And it's a real opportunity for us to seize, to rethink the interior electric power strategy and get cheap electricity, perhaps even cheap enough that you could offset diesel and wood heat with electric heat in the interim while we grow out that distribution grid in Fairbanks.
Madam Chair, again, Mark Begich for the record, if I could add just one more caveat on that.
Go ahead, Mr. Begich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is important, as Matt just described, it's about low cost. But one other thing, and Glen Farne can add to this, timing is also valuable, because if you can do it at the right time of the pipeline construction, the main pipeline, the mobilization of the equipment, the mobilization of the contracts, the mobilization of the crews could add a savings to that spur line if you do it right. And so we're looking at all those pieces. And I will say, you know, there is incredible technology developing, especially around heating systems, with electricity as the power. I mean, that's, you know, frankly, the hotel we have in Anchorage is all heat pump electrical units in our rooms, and we use gas to fire it up, and it is cheaper than us putting gas in every room, frankly. So there are new technologies being developed. That's what Matt has started to discuss. So again, we understand the value and importance of Fairbanks, because if Fairbanks is way too high, we're never going to be able to solve an Alaska problem that is energy.
Thank you. We'll move on to Representative Elam.
Thank you. I appreciate the conversation about the municipalities, but I was going to change the subject just slightly a little on this. I was hoping you could help me understand how this particular bill helps Alaska or Alaskans be more competitive or be competitive in the global market, for how this affects kind of the global selling of our resources.
Yeah. This is Matt Kissinger for the record, Representative Elam through the chair. As I presented that benchmarking at the beginning of this, so again, we're an order of magnitude higher than all these other jurisdictions. So if you look at the math that Department of Revenue showed, is around 45 cents, for, you know, close to 50 cents different. On a project like this, when you're looking at the sales price of LNG into Asia, that 50 cents will make all the difference in the world. It is more than enough to take you above the margin.
Thank you. Yeah, we've got plenty of conversation to have, but thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Sickle, I really appreciate you pointing out the price sensitivity to cost overruns. In the slides early on in the 30s pages, we're talking and all these rainbow charts, 33, 34, 35, we're looking at 100% overrun of the CapEx. I'm assuming the base CapEx is the $46 billion we talked about. And then in the tornado charts on 36 and 37, that sensitivity only goes up to 50%. I know you can only work with the numbers that you're given, and you seem to not be given any different numbers than we have, which is not current. But I'd like to see, as we move forward, the comparisons and the risks to the project, if that project overrun is significantly higher. So looking at one of the more recent LNG or the natural gas pipeline projects in Western Canada, and that is the Coastal GasLink project, and that one had initial estimate of $4.5 billion and a total of over three times that amount. So that is significantly beyond the cost estimates overruns potential that we have here on these rainbow charts and the tornado chart later. So I guess this is just a request that as we're moving forward, that we do look at what a higher cost overrun scenario would be until we get more accurate data from the project developer.
Madam Chair, if I could respond a little bit here. This is again Mark Baggage for the record. And revenue, I'm sure can do that, but the other thing we'll do, Representative Mears, we want to compare apples to apples. I have no idea about that Canada project. You know, this project has all its permits, all its litigation, all its native land claims issues, all the things that relate to it. So we want to compare apples to apples. Your concern is valid in regards to cost overruns, but we want to be, you know, look at the project as you bring that up, because one of the things that is happening in this project right now, and I'm sure Glen Farm can respond to that much clearer, and that is they are literally out and about now on justifying getting costs on the pipe itself. They feel very good on the second phase as they move forward, but I'm sure Department of Revenue can do whatever analysis you want, and will do that. But when we're talking about projects, I just asked the committee to allow us to compare apples to apples to make sure we're looking at the exact same conditions and situations.
Follow up with Through the chair, with respect, Senator Begich, the numbers that we have presented to us in this bill are on a cost estimate that was, it's multiple years old. And although it's been priced for, indexed for inflation, there's real costs that are being developed by the project developer that neither the Department of Revenue nor us as legislators have. So we're being asked to make decisions on a number that is not real. And that does not include the potential for cost overruns. We don't have enough information, not only to not compare it to the Canada project, but to any project, because we don't have that information. So I think it's a leap to ask us to make those decisions on a number that's not based in reality.
I've got you.
Madam Chair, and I'll do it. Madam Chair, Mark Banks for the record. And I again, here you represent mayors. We will give you that, but it is based on a baseline reality, and that is why the sensitivity design that was done by Department of Revenue gives a variety of percentage increase. But as it develops, you know, again, I would ask Glen Farn, they'll probably tell you there, this is all within the range of acceptable conditions and pricing. But I understand what you're saying, but I have to emphasize the point, and that is, as best they can disclose that information, they will do it for sure. But I just, you know, as long as we're on the same page in regards to information flow, we're all in.
And follow up, Mr. Kissinger.
Yep. Chair Fryer, thank you. Representative Mears through the chair. This is Matt Kissinger for the record. We have seen the updated cost estimates as AGDC, and we also have had Worley walk us through them, so we understand that they're at a Class 2 level, which I believe is a plus 15% error band. And while we are indeed using the previous iterations that had been updated to 2023 numbers and then inflated by Department of Revenue to 2026 numbers, I can tell you that they are within reason and not within the error bands that you're discussing. Now, with respect to the Coastal GasLink line, we do, as Mr. Begich mentioned, we do need to be apples to apples here. That line, they did not have land rights resolved in Canada, as we know. So there were issues with respect to that. They were building it during COVID. And most importantly, they were going through the coastal mountains that we are going around. And this was the hardest part of building TAPS, if you look at the historical record. And it would be the hardest part of building this pipeline to go through those mountains. Tunnels and pass crossings and tunnels and pass crossings at a time when they were hit by COVID and had massive unavailability of staff led to most of those cost overruns. And so it's a vastly different situation than you're looking at in Alaska, where we have an established right-of-way. We're coming down the TAPS right-of-way for the first half, cutting across to Nanana, and then coming down the railroad, and then the western side of the Susitna close to infrastructure for the rest of the way. So it's very different, and we need to compare more with some of the pipelines in Texas and other places.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Kissinger. Looking at potentials for cost overruns, those are particular to that project. When we're looking at Alaska construction, Santos was really lucky with the weather that they got for developing Pikka, and they were able to be ahead of schedule. This winter is not those circumstances. And if this pipeline was under construction over this winter, there would be project delays, and project delays cost money. So we need to be able to consider that this is a major infrastructure project in Alaska. Also, what are prices going to be? We're in a very volatile situation with, you know, not just the cost of materials, but really the cost of labor. We're competing against other Alaska development projects, as well as things going on in the lower 48 and across the world. Those are significant. They're different than happen in other projects, but we cannot dismiss the fact that we have to consider what cost overruns would do to our state, local budgets, and to our consumers.
Yep. Representative Mears through the chair, I absolutely agree with you, and 100% we should be doing sensitivities on CapEx overrun. It was more the magnitude I was discussing, I think we should be realistic about the magnitude of those potential cost overruns. What we also need to address is where does that cost overrun risk sit? And that has been a problem with this project for a long time. It's almost like the hot potato. The structure we have right now is a structure that works, where the party that's most able to mitigate cost overrun risk is the party that holds that risk. And that party is the project developer, not the state and not the local buyers of gas.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I was just going to suggest something, Madam Chair. This is Mark Baggins. I wonder if we want to have Glenfern at the table and maybe have DOR. It seems like we're going into the next phase of conversation, which I think Glenfern would be happy to go into more of that detail, but it's obviously your committee. I just want to make, I'm sure Adam is sitting there chomping at the bit to answer some of these questions.
Adam is here, but we do still have questions for the Department of Revenue. And that's actually, Representative Colomb is next in the
queue. Yeah, thank you, Chair. So it's been a while. I had a question for DOR a while ago, so I'm trying to remember. So I just need some clarification on your tornado charts. Is that what they're called? Page 37. So when you on the left-hand column, when it says gas cost per MCF, I know you were explaining that. Is that the cost that they would sell to the utility? Is that what that was?
Representative Colomb, through the chair, so looking at slide 37. So the gas cost is the purchase price to the upstream producers. Okay. And so what we're showing here is our baseline break-even LNG price into the market, given our baseline $1.50 per 1,000 cubic feet purchase price from the producers. And we're showing how a purchase price of $1 or $2 would increase or decrease that break-even sales price into the market.
Oh, okay. And so can you explain the orange and the blue line? What's the orange? Just means it's below the base price and above the base price. Okay.
Sure. Representative Colomb through the chair. So looking at slide 37 in detail, so our 2033 baseline break-even LNG export price, given all of our baseline modeling, this is before applying the proposal with the alternative volumetric tax, we assume a $9.07 break-even price into the market. And in the sensitivity here, we have five sensitivities that we ran for this particular chart, The first being moving from the property tax to the alternative volumetric tax, as shown in or as presented in the bill. You can see that's a little over a 50 cents decrease in the required export price. We show a sensitivities on the project CapEx of a 10% reduction or up to a 50% increase in project CapEx. And if we were to look at further cost overruns on project CapEx, it would be an extrapolation of this. So obviously, the risk in terms of the break-even price required by the developer, if CapEx prices come in significantly higher than our $46 billion baseline, that is a very material risk. Mm-hmm. We look at what is that required rate of return for the developer. So we've assumed a 10% rate of return as our baseline, and we look at the impact of if the developer only required a 7.5% return on investment or if they required a 15% return on investment. And then we talked about the gas costs, and then finally cost of debt. We assume that there will be a split between equity and debt financing for the project. The baseline assumption is a 5% interest cost for that long-term debt, and then we look at what the impact of a $3.5% or a 7% cost of debt would be.
Okay. I had a question for, I guess it was about the modeling too. So back to the spur line, what I heard is if you incorporated the Fairbanks spur line in the beginning, these sensitivity charts would not be accurate, correct? Like they would be, that would basically change the cost.
Representative Clem to the chair, and I guess Matt may have something to chime in here. So we have run these sensitivity charts assuming a portion of the gas is sold for in-state use. We're agnostic as in terms of modeling purposes, we're agnostic as to whether that in-state gas is into the South Central market or into a spur line.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. I'm next in the queue again. And I think it would probably be if we can get Adam to the question for Adam. I'm just going to make a statement. And so it's going to be very district specific. I'm 100% supportive of the project. I've consistently said as long as we're reliant on oil and gas, it should come from the North Slope. Very supportive. I would love to be a part of the legislature where this project moves forward and we realize an actual pipeline. But I represent District 40. I represent the North Slope and the Northwest Arctic. Of the 19 communities that I represent, only two of them enjoy natural gas. The rest of them are paying upwards of $17 a gallon for diesel fuel. You signed a contract 362 days ago. I think you said it was 360 when you were in front of us before. And it was presented earlier that property tax was always going to be a part of the discussion. You identified it. You knew that was going to be an issue. And so, if you were in my position, if you were the representative for District 40, or if you were the mayor of the North Slope Borough, how do you sell this concept to constituents considering that none of the North Slope communities will get any gas and now 90% reduction in property tax revenue? It's difficult for me.
Sure. Representative, Madam Chair, it's a great question. It's a very important question. I think when you look at the overall project impacts, it has a positive impact in multiple jurisdictions in multiple ways, and the team here has answered some of those angles. First being revenues to the state through property taxes, through corporate taxes, through royalties. Another angle is revenues directly through this alternative volumetric tax to municipalities. Then in addition to that, it is the benefit that comes from the additional growth and construction and activity that will occur in these jurisdictions. And so for the North Slope in particular, when you look at the entire Alaska LNG project, there is a large concentration of construction activity that needs to occur on the North Slope. That's jobs, that's more economic growth, as well as a significant additional gas exploration and development that will come as a result of this. I've got a firm belief that there is already a significant amount of gas on the North Slope, but having a reliable commercial outlet for all of that gas will lead to more positive production activity that will be beneficial to the borough.
Thank you, and I have a follow-up on that. So if we can go to slide 5. So in this slide, it shows tax incentives across the United States. Are there any other states that forego a property tax? I mean, I see property tax exemption. I see PILT agreements. I see long-term tax exemption laws. I see leasing back property. Do any of these states remove – is there property tax reform? Is that permanent?
We'd have to really look at a jurisdiction by jurisdiction. There are some places where property tax is extremely significant. It's not my area of expertise to be able to tell you kind of the full range and where each jurisdiction has different allocations. But as you can see here, there are some places where there is a very long-term complete reduction. There are some places where there are economic incentives created for different projects, but. If you'd like, Madam Chair, that's something we can follow up with a little more detail on.
Thank you. And maybe, if Mr. Stickle, do you know if any of the other jurisdictions have a permanent tax or property tax?
Co-Chair Freer, again, we'd have to do a little bit more research. I understand that property tax is an incentive, or adjustments of property tax are an incentive that are used fairly regularly for a variety of different projects. So I'm sure we could find examples where there's permanent reductions in property tax and everything in between.
Okay.
And that was Dan Stickle for the record.
And if I may, Brandon Spanos, for the record, generally a PILT is a payment in lieu of tax. And so the in lieu of is probably a property tax, but we'd have to look into it more. But that payment is an agreed upon amount, or in this case, it would be a volumetric tax.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Next in the queue, I've got Representative Prox.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Mr. Begich.
Mark Begich, can I answer one part? Yeah. Again, Mark Begich for the record. Also, just in this project, over that 30-year span, the legislature set up the Affordable Energy Fund. It would take a portion of the gas royalties, about $1.4 billion, give or take a little bit there, but around $1.4 billion that goes in the fund that will be available for additional energy projects outside of the gas line for areas of rural communities.
Okay, thank you. Representative Prox. I just want to do a time check. We've got about 16 minutes left in committee. There's another committee after. We could probably go a little bit longer, but there we do have to turn the room over for Labor and Commerce. I've got, for your all awareness, I've got Representative Prox, Representative Fields, Representative Elam, Representative Mears, then Representative Dibert. And we were just rejoined by Representative Sadler. Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. I guess, you know, just looking at it from my perspective, on the one hand, I have to think about what's the best deal for the state as a state legislator, but like everyone else in the room, we each have our individual districts. You have kind of both situations. So part of it is near the gas supply. The rest of it is way remote from the gas supply. And then there's going to be differences of the actual impact, the extra costs to the municipalities for dealing with people coming in and all that entails. Do we have, and this is, I suppose, for Mr. Stickle, I don't know, but if somebody else can do it, I don't care. Do we have a way of kind of estimating how much the different municipalities will be impacted, and in the short term and in the long term, I suppose. Do we have a way of looking at that?
Dan Stickle for the record, to represent Prax with the chair. So I would defer to the municipalities, or maybe some of my colleagues have some thoughts on the specific costs incurred by the municipalities. What we're looking at from Department of Revenue standpoint is the disposition of the revenue that would be coming in. So we can provide a detailed analysis of what revenue would accrue to each of those municipalities, but we're not doing the analysis of costs that would be incurred by the municipalities.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Begich.
Mark Begich, for the record, just quickly, there is an effort by mayors to identify that. That is in process. That's part of the conversation we're having with them. But do keep in mind, under current law, any construction period of a pipeline, LNG, or these types of facility, there is no requirement to, they're exempt from property taxes under the current law that's on the books today. We recognize that, and we're having these conversations with the mayors now, because under the law, they would, if this project was built, they'd get zero until it was operational. But we recognize that. We're having conversations about it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, if you'll allow, this is Adam Prestige for the record. It was mentioned a little bit ago that there has been a working group with the mayors, and that's been a really important and positive part of the process to get to where we are here today. It has been a process and a complicated bit of work at the same time. So we have five municipalities, each with different interests, concerns, and needs, and part of the reason the evolution of getting to where we are today with this alternative volumetric tax proposal is the outcome of very, very close collaborative work with the mayors to structure and achieve something that is beneficial and acceptable to everyone involved. That work continues. I think you'll hear from the mayors that they are supportive. The work is of fully ironing out an agreement is still ongoing, and the element of early impacts is part of what we're continuing to work on. I will say that our analysis by third-party advisors is that the construction period will generate billions of dollars of positive economic benefits to the municipalities where construction is being conducted. That's in the form of direct labor and jobs and supported indirect jobs created and all the revenue and economic activity surrounding that construction process. We discussed a little bit about the work with the mayors on additional interests and requirements, one of those being the Fairbanks spur line. I just want to point out, as we stand now with a fully permitted Alaska LNG project, the Fairbanks spur line is not part of that existing full permit package, and so that's part of the conversation to be had, but we're extremely open to working with the Fairbanks borough with Mayor Greyer Hopkins to find efficient way to do that. Obviously, we want to deliver gas to Alaskans up and down the rail belt, and so we're committed to figuring out the best way forward for that. There was also a discussion around equity in exchange for tax relief. What I want to say is I'm glad Mark brought up the state investment option, because that is a really important part of this project. When we look at Glenfarne being a co-owner and developer and operator of this project for the long term, we envision that with the state of Alaska being our long-term partner. So we welcome the state of Alaska exercising that equity option. How the state chooses to fund that, we generally are broadly supportive of however the state decides is in its best interest. It is, I'd say, almost impossible, however, to issue equity in exchange for tax relief. The equity investment that comes into the project, those dollars are used to pay for actual construction activities. And so if we're giving away equity in exchange for not getting dollars receiving investment at the time of construction, we'll have to go out and source those dollars somewhere else. And so it doesn't work for a project that is developed and financed in this way. Pardon me, Madam Chair, if you'll allow me, I also just want to correct one or two things for the record. One thing is we're not taxed. We're not an S-Corp. We will never be an S-Corp in Alaska. We have no intention or plans to be an S-Corp. We also, there's been quite a bit of discussion on cost overruns. And just to be clear, that's not a risk borne by the state. That if the state right now has no risk of losing money, they have their 25% interest in 8-Star Alaska, no risk of losing that interest, and no obligation to put in a dollar more. If the state decides to join with other investors and put dollars in at FID to invest in its investment option, then sure, the state will have some risk of cost overruns like all of the other equity investors who put their dollars at risk to build the project. But we will have long-term binding contracts to sell gas to ratepayers. Those will be multi-decade contracts with committed prices. So ratepayers do not bear the risk of a cost overrun. That is a risk borne by Glenfarne, the developers, and our investors. That's why we're working hard to minimize our risk and be very, very, very careful with everything that we do, because ultimately it's the developer that wears the risk of cost overruns.
Thank you, Mr. Prestige. I'm going to move on to our next is Representative Fields, and Representative Sather just joined us, so I'm going to let him hop the queue a little bit. Apologies, everybody. Representative Fields.
Through the chair, I appreciate Senator Begich bringing up the Rural Energy Fund, which I think was established under SB 138, and I was hoping maybe Dan Stickle could talk about how much revenue would you anticipate being generated if a gas line were developed under this bill, say at a range of production volumes with that, I believe it's 20% of state royalties.
Sure. Dan Stickle for the record, to Representative Fields through the chair. So under the baseline modeling assumptions that we've been presenting, including the $1.50 purchase price of gas increasing with inflation, over life of project, we assume $1.4 billion to the Affordable Energy Fund for that share of the royalties.
through the chair, what could we just have that in an annualized figure, please? Is that a 30-year, $1.4 billion over 30 years, or $1.4 billion over how many years?
Representative Fields, through the chair, so that's over the 32 years of LNG sales or 30 years of full project capacity. So the number is $437 million through 2042. It's $945 million through 2052, and it's $1.432 billion through 2062.
Okay.
So roughly, about a little over $40 million a year for those first 10 years.
Okay. Thank you. And my understanding is HB 381 does not alter that. I want to make sure my understanding of that is correct through the chair.
Representative Fields, through the chair, that's correct. So the bill in front of you alters the property tax only and does not impact royalties.
Okay. Can I ask one more follow-up, Representative? Chair Freer. So through the chair, thanks, Mr. Presage, for starting to address CapEx versus pricing to utilities. I think the biggest impact to consumers is through NSTAR. NSTAR is the largest purchaser, and I just wanted to ask that you all think about disclosing some details of what you're negotiating with NSTAR, because I think it does enhance the argument that this is in the public interest if we can show that under the contract that you all are negotiating, you do bear the risk of cost overruns. That's very compelling, actually, in terms of showing the need for the project, and that if the CapEx doubled, we would be paying the same as NSTAR customers, and the developer bears that risk. So I think the more details you're able to show, the more compelling a case that we can make.
Representative Fields, through the chair. That's a great point. Thank you. The Regulatory Commission of Alaska has a very robust process for evaluating gas sales contracts and making sure that they are in the interest of ratepayers. It is a fully transparent process where the contract itself will be filed in front of the RCA. It becomes a public contract, publicly viewable contract at that point, subject to, you know, any level of scrutiny and analysis. And so we're fully prepared for that, and there should be an understanding in the market that all of these details that we're talking about will be viewable in black and white letters.
Thank you. Next, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being absent, and I apologize if the questions I'd like to ask have been asked and answered already, but I have many questions, a couple dozen, but I'm only going to get a few. The volumetric, the alternate volumetric tax, are there any other natural gas pipeline projects that use this tax method to assess property taxes on the LNG facilities? If so, where? And if so, what parallels are there to Alaska that indicates this is the appropriate taxation model?
This is Matt Kissinger for the record, Representative Sadler through the chair. I have experience on a major oil pipeline that utilized this method. This is the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan oil pipeline that we built from Azerbaijan through Georgia and into Turkey. And the Georgia section of that pipeline, and remember, this is in the early 2000s when Georgia needed the funds desperately. And BTC used a volumetric payment through Georgia. And what it achieves, and what it'll achieve in Alaska as well, is this sense of alignment as we move forward and begin expanding and growing the project, so that you're not, every time you have a change or a new opportunity, you're not back battling it. Instead, you're all aligned and moving forward to try and achieve it, because higher rates benefit everybody.
Representative Sadler, if I may, I think there's another similar structure here in Alaska where there is a per unit royalty tax on gas that's produced, and so it's not necessarily a pipeline, but it is a per unit. It is a per unit production tax where there is alignment. The more gas that flows, the more revenue that comes to the state.
Thank you. And that was certainly on a production tax basis. Yes, that's based on volumetric. I think that's oil and gas and oil, but not actually as I'm curious to find it, what other cases where it's actually a substitute for the property tax. One of the questions I had as I read through the bill is, does locking into the volume deprive the state or the operators of any potential upside if there was some, I don't know, world oil or an energy cataclysm that raised the value of natural gas? Under the normal property tax assessment process, the economic value of the, what's delivering that gas might be assessed as being more valuable. If the price of gas doubles, the value of that gas doubles, and the value of the pipeline would double, and therefore the property tax assessment should increase. This arrangement deprives the state of that opportunity. Is that deliberate, or what, is that a benefit, or is that a bug or a feature?
Representative Sally, through the chair, that's a feature. And so when you're developing a very large, complex infrastructure project, everyone involved in that project wants the financials of that project to be super, super stable. And so infrastructure developers like Glenfarn and the ADSTAR Alaska joint venture, we're not looking at this project thinking, to put it in other terms, there is being an infrastructure business that relies on a fixed set of revenue returns, or there's a commodity business where we're selling a commodity at a price, at a market price, and we take a risk based on whether that price is high or low. There's a commodity risk taken when the producers on the North Slope sell gas to us, but for ADSTAR Alaska, for Glenfarn and AGDC, the Alaska LNG project makes its money based on fixed infrastructure returns. And so if I'm in your position looking at how does the state benefit from strong market environments, it is on the tax that is assessed on the commodity itself.
That last point, I want to
follow up.
But I think where I want to go with, and maybe a future time, is a relationship between the state's interest as a landowner, and therefore should get some property tax on the equipment on its land, versus the state's position as an equity owner in the businesses doing this. And I need to understand the interplay there, because and so I'll be respectful and leave it there and pick up later. I'll get back in the queue.
Well, I did get permission to stay over for 5 minutes, so if you would like to respond or...
The Representative Sadler through the chair, this is Matt Kissinger for the record. I just want to emphasize something that Adam brought up a bit earlier that people need to understand about this project that makes it quite a bit different than the oil pipeline, and that is the element of project finance. So oil projects are often financed off of the balance sheets of the producers, or the developers of the project, sponsors. And that means that as gas prices and oil prices go up and down, they're not stuck with long-term contracts that they had to get into in order to finance it. They reap the benefits of the high oil price, and they suffer the low oil prices. Like with all the major gas projects, LNG projects, because they are so capital intensive, which is why property tax is so important. They're so capital intensive, you have to project finance it. What project finance means is that there's no recourse up to the project sponsors. The credit worthiness of the project hangs on the agreements that are entered into at the time of FID. And so you're entering into long-term gas supply agreements on the upstream, and you're entering into long-term LNG and gas sales agreements on the downstream before you go to FID. So if in the future gas prices blow through the roof, you don't necessarily reap any of that benefit because you have a long-term contract. It's the people clamoring for spot gas, the people that are short gas, like right now. As Qatar goes offline, it's the people who need to buy and fill their void because they didn't have it filled by long-term contracts. They're the ones that suffer, and the sellers in that spot market are the ones that win. We won't necessarily have a huge place in the spot market because this is such a big contract project. It'll need to be really contracted, you know, substantially.
A little one, tiny one to wrap up?
Tiny one.
Easy one. Is the 1% annual increase in the alternative volumetric tax capped, or does that increase 1% a year forever?
Sure, Dan Stickle for the record, to Representative Sadler through the chair. So it's 1% annually into perpetuity is what's in the bill.
My compound interest tables and see what that goes. Okay. Okay, great.
Thank you. Really quick, Representative Elam, I have 3 minutes.
Thank you. I appreciate all the information. It's been a lot of really good information. And so my question is the projections that you guys were making, and I apologize, I don't have the slides in front of me right in this moment, but what percentage of total production rate are those estimates made out, or the assumptions made of? Is that, you know, a full pipeline or half a pipeline?
Representative Elam, through the chair, so we assume that the project will be operating at full capacity starting in 2033 is what's baked into the modeling. So there are the project comes online with in-state sales first, and then there's 2 years of ramping up as of the first couple of trains are brought on in succession, and then from 2033 on, we assume full capacity at the 3.5 billion cubic feet per day capacity.
Thank you.
And their Representative Fields has a follow-up.
A follow-up to go, if you could give us information modeled at, say, 200,000 MCF, so essentially in-state, 500,000 MCF, and then I think 1 million MCF, if I'm getting the units right, sort of stages toward a full pipeline and associated impacts on pricing, that would be valuable. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Well, with that, it's 3:03, and I anticipate, I know there will continue to be questions. Usually I ask folks to email questions, but I would like to have them on record and in another committee. So we hope to see you all again very soon in a future hearing. And with that, that completes the agenda for our House Resources Committee meeting today. Our next House Resources Committee meeting is Friday, March 27, 2026, where we will take up House Bill 266 relating to the transfer of big game hunting permits and hear a presentation on the history of electrification in the rail belt. The time now is 3:04 p.m., and this hearing of the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.